Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on You Can Beat City Hall when we come back. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we seem to be among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies, multinational corporations, lobbies, and the news media. But you know, we don't have to remain helpless. The institution designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is called the judicial power. The courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, liberties, and property, not the Congress, not the political process. Now, did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights? Not to one who is indifferent thereto. It is a fighting clause, and its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat. It cannot be claimed by an attorney or a solicitor, and it is valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person. So says U.S. versus Johnson. And that's why I contend that we should listen more to the judges and less to the politicians and the lawyers. Now, did you hear what that judge said in that statement? He said, your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or your solicitor. Your rights can only be claimed by you, the belligerent claimant in person. Now, if you'd like to learn more about rights and courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. And best of all, it's free of charge. Now, the school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. That's the place to start, the free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, in our struggle against City Hall, in our struggle against the establishment, the system, the insurance companies, the medical profession, the government bureaucracy, you have to practice all of the laws all of the time, and there's three sets of laws. First of all is the law of God at the top of the heap, and the Congress and the Supreme Court recognize in Public Law 97-280. Statute 96-12-11, that the Scripture is the final authority on law. The Supreme Court reaffirmed that principle of law in a case called Seeger versus United States. Seeger, S-E-E-G-E-R versus U.S., or it's probably listed U.S. versus Seeger. And then God himself in Acts 5 verse 29 told us that we ought to obey God rather than men. George Washington made a clever observation. He said that the Constitution of the United States was made for a moral people. So the Constitution of the United States does not work for people who are basically immoral. Immoral. Do not practice the Mosaic Law. They don't practice the law of God. They don't have a set standard of right and wrong, good and evil. You know, life is kind of gray. There was a fellow who was on 60 Minutes the other night, and they were talking about a case where this policeman was investigating a crime, and this witness came up to the policeman and said, "Let me tell you what I saw." And he told him what he saw, and the policeman said, "If you testify to that in court, you're going to get hurt and your family's going to get hurt," and intimidated this guy into lying on the witness stand against a defendant who was innocent. And this guy spent 19 years in prison on the false testimony of this perjured witness who was intimidated by the policeman. The policeman wasn't moral, and the witness wasn't moral. And these kinds of relevant or relative standards, rather than absolute standards of morality or the kiss of death if you want to fight City Hall. The guy that fights City Hall has to have a sense of right and wrong, good and evil, and a sense of morality, ethics. This is right, that's wrong. And I'm going to fight for what's right, and I'm going to stick with it. And in the stories that I've been telling you, in every case, these are people who have staked out their turf and said, this is right, that's wrong, here's what we're going to do. And surprisingly, they come out on top every time. Every time. I've been observing this now for 60 years. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story here about this thing of you can beat City Hall. It doesn't just occur in the United States. It isn't something that we Americans have a corner on the market to. You know, everybody in the world wants to beat City Hall. Everybody in the world wants to take on the evils of insurance or the evils of medicine and defeat them. Most people never succeed in that goal, basically because they themselves are immoral. They don't have standards by which they can stand or rest upon. So when the going gets tough, they cave in, they give up and quit. Just like that witness I told you about. When the policeman threatened him and his family, he didn't have the moral fortitude to say, you know, right's right and wrong's wrong. Come hell or high water is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do what's right. Well, the Muslims have a standard of right and wrong. You know, irrespective of what you think of Muslim theology, they know that theft is wrong. Muslims, from the time they're little children, and we Americans, you know, Christians used to be taught in this country from the time they were little children that theft was wrong, that sodomy was wrong, that adultery was wrong. See, we used to know right and wrong, good and bad. Then they told us, well, we can't really be 100% sure. It's kind of a gray area. Well, for people that operate in the gray area, they don't have a sense of moral balance. Muslims do. Muslims know that theft is wrong, and so they don't steal. They know that rape is wrong, so they don't rape. In other words, the Muslims have a system of morality and ethics that they practice to this day, and it's what separates the Muslims from the Christians and everybody else in the world. Now, they too like to fight City Hall, and they've got a unique methodology for doing this, at least in the realm of economics and taxation. So I'm going to cite from the Privateer, the latest issue of the Privateer, which you can get a copy of. The Privateer comes out of Queensland, Australia. The publisher is William A.M. Buckler, Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, Australia, 4567. And they've also got a web page. If you'd like, you could just go on to their web page. It's www.the-privateer.com. There's a hyphen in the Privateer. And that's the name of the publication, the Privateer. Now, if you want to send them an email, then it's capt@the-privateer.com. All right, so let me tell you a little story here about the Muslims and how they deal with a thing called the Hawala. It's their payment system. In Tehran, Iran, they maintain that it has an ongoing plan to set up an oil trading exchange to compete with New York's NYMEX and with London's International Petroleum Exchange. The Iranians want to run their oil bursts in euros, not in dollars. They have repeatedly stated that their euro oil exchange will start up in June. And in regard to the Iranian exchange arriving, there has been a steady drumbeat of news across the Western press that this exchange will never work. A constant in all of these articles in the mainstream Western press is that the Iranians will not be able to establish all of the trading rules and regulations that prevail in the West, and that therefore the Iranian exchange will never work. Well, this misrepresents what the Iranians are in fact about to do. Likely it's being done by intent. You see, based upon their own statements, the Iranians have absolutely no intention whatsoever to establish a copy of any Western exchange. What they are in fact designing is a Muslim exchange. Islamic banking works under what we call the Hawala payments system, spelled H-A-W-A-L-A, the Hawala payment system. And under this system, methods of payment are often faster and cheaper than Western wire services. The Hawala system is impossible to regulate. The problem is the much higher use of cash, and much of the clearing or the balancing of payments across the Muslim world is done in hard currencies such as gold. Let me pause here and make an observation. Remember, our God told us, He said, "You shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag." When we practiced gold and silver under the Coinage Act of 1792 here in America, we had privacy in our business transactions and we didn't have an income tax. You see, the income tax is predicated upon a paper trail, predicated upon records. Americans have been taught to become practicing communists and to deal in commercial paper and banks, the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto, and income tax, the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security, the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto, and to waive their rights to property, the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, and to educate their children in the state's doctrine, the tenth plank to the Communist Manifesto. Muslims are fiercely anti-communist because communism runs counter to Muslim theology. So the Muslims stick to their theology, and their theology has a moral standard. And they use hard currencies like gold, and they deal in cash, and they don't create paper trails, and they are much better, much more able, much more successful in defeating City Hall. Going on, and they tell us that all transaction records are immediately destroyed after the completion of any exchange or payment. Pause. Notice that all transaction records are immediately destroyed after the completion of any exchange or payment. Now, if you're operating in a corporation, a licensed business, under the income tax, federal tax ID number, Social Security, you have to keep records. It's the law. But if you don't have a business license, don't deal in Social Security, don't deal in unjust weights and balances and commercial paper, and you do deal in hard currency like gold and silver, then you don't have to keep any records. And you're in compliance with the law. Going on. There are no rules that either the sender or the receiver be identified. Total anonymity. So in practice, it works like this. A man from the Philippines, who happens to be a Muslim, working in one of the Emirates in the Gulf, gets paid. The Philippine man then walks over to the bazaar or souk and he finds a money changer. He hands the money changer a large part of what he has just earned, and a few days later his wife, living in the southern Philippines, walks into a small Muslim office or shop, and there she gets the money. The physical evidence of this transaction is then totally destroyed. It is as if the payment never happened. In many ways, the Muslim Hawala system works in a similar manner to the system in the Middle Ages in Europe. The payment system of our ancient forefathers in the Middle Ages was largely based upon letters of credit. So at the great trading fairs of medieval Europe, people from all over Europe showed up carrying letters of credit, but they had very little money. Upon presentation of their letters of credit, they could open an account at the fair. Then they bought, sold, and traded. They borrowed, they lent, and they worked up a trading storm at such European fairs, and when the fair was over and everything was completed, all of these trades were cleared. And only there, where there was a difference, was the difference then settled in cash money, gold coin. Then the records were destroyed. The merchants, that's what they were, who operated this system of letters of credit, or as the Muslims call it, the hawala system, would later do a version of clearing among themselves, and again, only when there was a net difference was that settled by cash or a money transfer. Then they too destroyed their own records. After all, there's no need for records. All payments had been made, and there were no credits, and there were no debits outstanding, cash and carry. This next to invisible system drove the kings, the nobles, and other aristocrats and tax collectors crazy. And it did the same to the greatest landowner of the epoch, which was the Catholic Church. Now, all of these official authorities knew what was going on, but they couldn't see it, and they couldn't do anything about it. A dusty young Swede was in a different position. He could walk or ride all the way from Stockholm to one of these fairs with only a piece of paper in his pocket. And once he got there, he could trade up a storm. He could then take and make his way back to Stockholm carrying another piece of paper. Back home in Stockholm, he presented that piece of paper to a local merchant who promptly handed him a purse filled with Swedish gold coins. And then the evidence of the transaction simply disappeared, as it was destroyed. This global Muslim payment system is driving Western intelligence agencies like the CIA around the bend because it is so opaque. There are next to no records, and the records which do exist at any time are destroyed on a rolling basis once the transactions have been completed. Western taxing authorities are just as livid. Without a long-lasting paper trail, who can find out who makes what income and then tax them for it? So this is the kind of system that the Iranians are going to establish. The Iranian Euro Oil Exchange will, in part, operate on this basis. Muslims, except excellent in all forms of trade and exchange, will, of course, interact with Western banks and then connect to the Western payment system using the euro, but also other Western currencies beside the dollar. But basically, the Muslim hawala payment system will also be there, should any Westerner desire to use it. Now, the system is perfect for criminal activity, but it is also perfect for honest traders who want their privacy. And it is impenetrable by Western tax systems and Western tax authorities. Now, the gold, the dinar, and the geopolitics of money come into play. It all started with the Great Silk Road. More than 1,000 years ago, after the Muslims had surged out of Arabia and presented Christian Europe with a near mortal challenge, they had also surged up to the gates of the stale East Roman Empire at Constantinople. The Muslims traded up and down the east coast of Africa and across the north coast of Africa to Morocco and Niger. They had also crossed Persia with their sailing dhows and followed the annual monsoon winds to India, down to Singapore today, and then across to the Philippines. And annual Muslim caravans traveled to China across the Great Silk Road, where the Chinese traders wanted payments in silver and gold. This enormous trading system lasted for multiple centuries. With the Muslims came the hawala payment system and the gold dinar. After Columbus had gained North America, Spaniards stood on the western shores of the Pacific Ocean, and they promptly made their way across the Pacific and got the shock of their lives when they arrived in the Philippines. There, in the Philippines, the Muslims were there first, and they had been there for many centuries before the Spaniards arrived. And the driving force behind all of these great Western sailings to discover the world had one central political purpose, and that purpose was to find a way around, to beat City Hall, to find a way to trade without paying these huge Muslim fees and taxes in these huge Muslim areas, so as to connect directly with the Spice Islands to China and to the tea and the silk and the rare woods of the Orient, and last but not least, to earn the profits from all such trades. Well, you know, when we Americans and Englishmen, we Westerners, practiced this system of cash and carry, that is, we used just weights and balances when we believed in God and when we obeyed God and kept His commandments and practiced the economic laws, you know, we all made out better. Today, in modern America, if you're the average Joe Sixpack American and you're out here making $100,000 a year, you're paying $74,000 in taxes and you get to keep and spend $26,000 of it any way you want to. Now, a lot of times people will challenge me on that 74%, but boys and girls, you're not paying just income tax or Social Security tax. You pay 14 taxes. 14. And you may not be paying all 14 taxes, but that's irrelevant. You don't have to pay tax to the Securities and Exchange Commission, but you can rest assured that McDonald's does. And when you go down to McDonald's and buy a Big Mac, you can rest assured that you're paying tax. It's what we call a hidden tax, of which there are 257 hidden taxes on a single Big Mac that you buy at McDonald's. 257 hidden taxes. So whether or not you directly pay that tax or not, it's irrelevant. The fact is that you are paying that tax in the purchase price because McDonald's is a corporation and corporations don't pay tax. You pay it all. Now, the Muslims have a morality system. They have a system of morality and ethics that we in the Western world do not have because we're practicing communists. This is not a system for communists. This is not a system that will work in America, or England, or France, or Canada, or Australia. But it will work in those countries among people who have morality and ethics. So if you're the only guy in your local area, and you want to practice the kind of ethics that come from the Ten Commandments, you too can beat City Hall. The Muslims do. And so can you. Now, let me tell you a little story along this line of taxation over here that has to do with an old man who came to school, oh, hell, 20 years ago now. And he was a funny old guy. He was 76 years old 20 years ago when he walked in my door, just livid. He was just mad as a hornet. He was as mad as a wet hen. You see, he had six houses in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and a 20-acre parcel of land down in Florida. Now, he'd been a wage earner all of his life, but he was a thrifty, hard-working man. He and his wife had accumulated in their lifetime six houses. And back in the Depression years, he was buying these houses that were distressed and then fixing them up and renting them out. He owned these six houses in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, free and clear. At the time, back in the mid-1980s, they were worth about $100,000 apiece. And the 20 acres of land that he had in Florida was worth about $100,000. So he had about $700,000. Now, I'll take that back. I think that piece of ground was worth $600,000, and his houses were worth $6,000. It was $1.2 million, I believe it was. Now, he had been successful in business. He had been successful as a wage earner. And he had been thrifty. And he worked hard. And now the government came in and they put a $27,000 lien on his six houses in Baton Rouge. All six houses had a $27,000 lien. He's 76 years old. He comes to school and he wants to know how to get this lien taken off of his property. Now, boys and girls, once the IRS has put a lien on your property, you're not going to get the lien off until you satisfy the lien, and then the IRS takes it off. A lien is something that you put on property to protect your interest. Now, rent, by definition, is income. And this man had income. He was a wage earner, and he had rents. And he had a social security account, and he had a checking account, and he did all the things that normal people do living their lives in America. And he didn't pay his taxes. Now, the saving grace was that once you get to be 70 years old, the IRS is loath to come against you and throw you in jail. Now, Irwin Schiff was an exception to the rule, but generally they leave old people alone. It's bad public relations. And the government is satisfied and content when you get to be 70. They know you're going to die in a few years, and so they're going to get it all. So they put a lien on this old man's property. He's going to die, and when he dies, the heirs won't know how to satisfy the lien. By then, the lien penalties and interest will be so high that the IRS will come in and take all the property. I mean, why take $27,000 when we can take $600,000? And so I told the man, I said, sir, you don't have a tax problem. You don't have a tax problem. You have a business problem. Business, not tax. He thought he had a tax problem. His problem's not tax. He owes the tax. In fact, he probably owes more than $27,000. Probably. I don't know that, but I've been around for a while, and I just kind of figured he probably did. And then I said, now, sir, here's the way this game is going to be played. You're going to die, and when you die, your heirs will not inherit the property. The IRS will tie it up in litigation, and ultimately the IRS will walk off with all or most of the equity in those properties. I said, is that what you want the outcome of this to be? And he got meaner yet. And he, no, 1,000 times no. I said, okay. So, is it possible that you want the IRS to get the hell out of your life so that you can pass these six houses on to your son? He only had one heir, one son. That's all these old people had. It was one boy. And he said, yes, that's what I want. I want everything to go to my son. I said, okay. Then why don't we formulate a plan? And why don't we see if we can execute that? So we put him through tax school, and when he got through tax school, now with a little better understanding of the law and a little better understanding of the taxing system and how the game is played, I said to the old man on Friday, I said, now do you have $27,000 with which to pay this lien? And he said, yeah, I do. I said, good. Here's the way you do it. You go down to the IRS, and you give them a written offer to settle the account for the $27,000 if they will remove the lien. And, of course, the IRS called him, and they said, yeah, we'll do that. Good. I said, now you go down, and you put the $27,000, this is going to be a cashier's check from the bank, in the exact amount, to the penny, on the counter. And you get a lien release before you let go of the check, because if this IRS guy is dishonest, he'll take your check and cash it, and then they won't give you the lien release. And then you forget about it, and then years later, they've still got the lien. Now, they got paid the $27,000, they still come back and take another $27,000 plus interest, plus penalties, plus the property. As I make sure that lien release is in your grubby hand before you let go of the cashier's check. He said, okay, I'll do that. Now this old guy went down followed instructions, got the lien release, and now his property is free and clear again. Free of all encumbrances. He then turned around and he sold all six pieces of property. I mean, after all, taxes on this property are not due until next April the 15th, are they? So he sold the property over in Florida, and he sold all of his houses in Baton Rouge, and he converted the $1,200,000 to gold coin. Gold, G-O-L-D. And then he went out into the swamps and he buried it. He and his boy buried it in the swamp. Then he came back and he filled out his tax return. And he said on his tax return, I owe you $357,000 in capital gain and income taxes. But I don't have any money. And I'm willing to sign a payment agreement. And the old man died owing the government $357,000. Now, who says you can't beat City Hall? Now, the government had in their wicked and evil mind to steal this man's property that he'd worked all of his life for. And because of his ignorance and not understanding the tax laws and rules and regulations and listening to some patriot group con him into this tax protest program, he was about to lose it all. But fortunately, he got his wits and his capacity back, and he formulated a plan, and when he got through executing his plan, I'm sure he's dead by now. And I'm sure his son knows where the gold is buried and lived his life happily ever after. Let me give you a reminder on the privateer. This is The Privateer, published by William A.M. Buckler, and I recommend it very highly. This is volume number 551, late April issue, the one that had the Hawala story in it, and it's theprivateer.com, the-privateer.com. And if you want to email him, you can write an email to capt@the-privateer.com, or you can write to William A.M. Buckler, Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, that's N-O-O-S-A, H-E-A-D-S, Queensland, 4567, Australia. Again, that's Noosa Heads, N-O-O-S-A, H-E-A-D-S, Queensland, 4567, Australia. I think you'll be glad you did. If you've got the stomach for bad news, Mr. Buckler certainly has it. If you want to know what's going on in the world where the bodies are buried and the rubber meets the road, The Privateer is the publication to subscribe to. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4000. 4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give out do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. You know, one time I was dealing with an airline called Frontier Airlines. A student of mine wanted me to come out to Kansas City, Missouri, and speak to a group of people. And so, in those days at Barrister's Inn, if you wanted me to come and speak, you sent me a round-trip ticket so that I could come out to where you are holding your meeting, and then I've got my ticket so I can get back home. You got to pay my airfare both ways. And then you got to pay the hotel bill and pay my board bill. I didn't charge anything. You know, the service is free. Be happy to come out and talk. But you gotta cover my expenses. And so, this guy's name is Marvin. And old Marv, he sent me a round trip ticket, and the ticket, now I'll take that back. Yeah, I got a round trip ticket. On a regional airline was called the Frontier Airlines. I heard the other day that there's a Frontier, it's not the same corporation, but it's a Frontier Airlines in operation today. But this operation, Frontier Airlines, operated out of Denver, Colorado, and we were in Boise, Idaho, and so as a regional air carrier, they happened to go to Kansas City. So, you know, Denver to Kansas City to Boise, Idaho, and it's pretty handy, and I don't care what airline I'm flying on. Well, Marvin sent the tickets. And my job is to go to the Frontier Airlines ticket counter, pick up the tickets. So it's all done by wire. He went down and paid the fare in some office in Kansas City. And at 3:30 in the afternoon, I came tripping into the Boise airport, and I walked up to the Frontier counter and smiled broadly and said, "My name is George Gordon, and I'm here to pick up a round-trip ticket on today's flight at 4:30 to Kansas City, Missouri, and returning on Monday." And she went flipping through the files over there, whipped out the tickets, and she says, "Oh, yes, Mr. Gordon, here they are. leaves on today's flight, Kansas City, and you return on Monday." She says, "Now, do you have some identification?" So I said, no, as a matter of fact, I don't have any identification. And she was kind of surprised, and she said, "What? Well, why don't you have identification?" And I said, "Because I know who I am. And I don't need to carry any identification. I don't have amnesia. I know who I am, and everybody that knows me knows who I am, and I get along quite nicely." And she said, "Well, it's company policy that before we give this ticket out, we have to have positive identification. Why, anybody could just walk in here and claim to be George Gordon and pick up this ticket." And I thought, well, yeah, I guess long before anybody had thought of identity theft, I guess somebody could walk in there. So I said, well, how many people have walked in here so far today claiming to be George Gordon and could identify the flight that he leaves on today, the flight that he returns on Monday, and the guy that sent the ticket was Marvin Porter? And she said, well, nobody. Nobody's come in today and made that claim. I said, well, that's a pretty good indication that I am who I say I am. And she said, well, I'm sorry, company policy, no ID, no ticky. I said, well, what is it that you want for ID? She says, a driver's license. To which I responded, well, lady, let's suppose for the sake of our discussion that I was an Amish man. Amish men don't drive. Amish men don't have driver's license. So when an Amish man walks in and says, I want to get my ticket, what do you do with him? And she said, well, then you have to give us a social security number. This is back in the early 80s when it was still against the law to use a social security number for identification purposes. And in fact, my social security card that I received said, not for identification, right on the little card. They don't anymore. Of course, now they use it for your national ID number. In fact, I think it's the mark of the beast. Day's coming when you won't be able to buy, sell, or trade without it. But I said, well, the same Amish man that doesn't have a driver's license doesn't have Social Security either. Now what do you do? She says, well, then he's got to have some form of state identification, to which I reminded her that there are a number of religious groups, organizations, and sects that don't have identification simply because they don't contract with foreign and alien gods like the state of Idaho. But she was adamant, and she said, no ticky, no laundry. No ticky, no flyee today. And this was long before Homeland Security, the Patriot Act, and the obnoxious flat-chested twits that we now see in the airports giving us fits when we want to fly on airplanes. And this was still in the days of competitive capitalism. So I said, well, okay, lady, but my customer in Kansas City, Mr. Porter, when I don't arrive there, is going to be very upset. And in fact, lady, if I don't get on that airplane at 4:30 today, I'm going to be very upset. Really upset. And she said, well, then she's starting to get a little snippy now. Well, then you better go get some identification like all the rest of us. In other words, you need to get in line just like all the rest of the sheep and come down the chute like everybody else. We don't tolerate individuals in this country. We only have mass migration, like a flock of blackbirds following their leader. Well, I'm not a blackbird, and I don't follow my leader very well. And so I said, okay, well, I'm going to go over there and sit down, and I'm going to wait until 4:30. And if the real George Gordon comes in and claims the ticket, then you're going to know that I'm an imposter. But if nobody else comes in to claim the ticket, and I'm the only George Gordon that has ever come in to claim the ticket, then you ought to know that I'm the real George Gordon. So I went over, I sat down, and I waited until about 4:15, 4:20. They're announcing the plane. You know, last call, get on board the plane. I walk over to the counter, and I said, has Mr. Gordon come in to claim the ticket yet? God, she was just livid. I mean, nasty. And so I went to the window, and I watched Frontier Airlines, the 4:30 flight, take off into the sunset. Well, in this case, they were taking off into the sunrise because they were traveling east. So now I'm sitting here with no ticky, and I'm not on the airplane, and Mr. Porter is going to be in Kansas City at 9:30 tonight waiting for me, and I'm not going to be there. So I went over and I got on the phone and I called my office and I said, this is what happened. And so I got the number of Mr. Porter and I got up back on the phone and I called Mr. Porter and I told him what the problem was. And indeed, predictably, he was pretty upset. And I said, never fear with old George here, and let me see if I can rectify this. So I walked over to the United Airlines ticket counter. And a bright young lady, just like the one over at Frontier, came up. And she says, you know, how can I help you? And I said, could I buy a ticket from Boise to Kansas City? Can I pay you cash without any identification? And she looked at me like I was suffering from the terminal stupids. Now, of course, today you couldn't go in there and buy a ticket without identification. But, you know, there was a time in America when you could walk in and buy a ticket on an airliner without identification. And that's what surprised me here with the Frontier people, see. And so she said, well, certainly, sir. And I said, good. They're terrific. Just sell me a ticket. And so she did. She sold me a ticket round trip, and I paid her in $100 bills. And I mean, if you paid your airline ticket in $100 bills today, they'd arrest you and throw you in jail for drug dealing. See? I mean, the concept that anybody in America today had any money in their pocket is preposterous. The only thing that Americans use is credit and credit cards. But you know, boys and girls, gold is the medium of exchange of kings, and silver is the exchange of gentlemen, and barter is the exchange of peasants. Debt is the medium of exchange of slaves. And boys and girls, I'm not a peasant. And I'm not a slave. And there are no ears, there are no holes in these Gordon ears. So I called my customer back and I got on the 9:30 flight out of Boise. And at about 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning, I arrived in Kansas City. Now, we're talking about how to beat City Hall. And you're probably sitting there saying, well, what in the hell has this got to do with beating City Hall? Well, pay attention now, boys and girls. Get your pencil out, sharpen it on both ends. I spoke to about 200 people at a meeting in Kansas City. And in the meeting, I told these people, 200 people, about my recent experience with Frontier Airlines. And I said to these people, If you have identification, you can fly on Frontier, but if you're like I am and you don't have identification, you can't fly on Frontier, so don't waste your time. Go to United. You don't need identification to fly on United. Now, boys and girls, I had collected my tickets at the counter on numerous flights. You know, I used to fly in airplanes quite a bit. And until I run into that Frontier thing, you know, when you walk up and said, I'm George Gordon, and if you could identify the flight number, the return flight number, and the person who sent that ticket, that was, you know, just as good as a secret code that would tell you that this has got to be the real George Gordon. Now, sometimes they'll say, okay, you got to have a code. And so you'd walk up and say, code 37. And or you know, some other secret code word, you know, like Captain Midnight secret code ring. And then they'd say, oh, yeah, that's the code. And, okay, you must be the right guy. Not at Frontier. So I encouraged the crowd, 200 people, I encouraged them not to fly on Frontier Airlines. And I encouraged them to fly on United or any other airline, but never on Frontier, and that every time they go to the airport, they walk up to the Frontier counter and say, I would fly on Frontier Airlines, but I can't because I don't have any identification. And then just walk away. Now, when I got home, I wrote a letter to Frontier Airlines in Denver, Colorado, and they never even wrote me a response. Now, you would have thought that they would have written me a letter back and said, listen, Gordon, why don't you just go to hell? Or something. I mean, these guys didn't even respond. So I wrote them another letter. And I said, hey, I wrote you a letter. You didn't even respond. I got a letter the second time. The second letter said, we've got our company policy, and we stand behind our young lady, and she followed company policy, and blah, 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 blah. Now listen, boys and girls. Frontier Airlines, about 2 or 3 years later, went bankrupt and out of business. Now maybe the young lady did the exact right thing, and she was just goody goody two shoes. But I want to tell you, boys and girls, you got to be able to solve your customers' problems when you're in business. You can't offend your customer. I mean, you can't walk into your customer's store, and he says, "Hey, Gordon, you delivered this furniture and it broke." You apologize. You say, "God, I'm sorry as hell that it broke. Probably it was his damn warehouseman that broke it." But you take it back, you smile, and you eat it, because this guy's your bread and butter. This is the guy, you know, maybe he's taking advantage of you this time. But you have to please your customers. Now, I want to point out, and I pointed this out to the Frontier lady. I said, "Now, lady, when that airplane takes off at 4:30, is it booked solid, or are there going to be some empty seats?" And she said, "No, it's not booked solid." I said, "Well, then, even if I'm the wrong George Gordon, it isn't going to cost you anything because you got empty seats in there anyway." And she said, no identification, no ticket. You know, one of these days, you know, no social security number, you don't get into a Walmart store. Well, it's coming. It ain't here yet, but it's coming. It's already there with the airlines. If you don't have state-issued ID, you can't fly on the airline. Okay. It's not my loss. I can get from here to there without an airliner. I'll do something else. Hell, I'll walk if I have to. Now, I went to work on that project. And in all of my meetings, and in all of the literature that I sent out, I told the Frontier Airlines story. I never spoke to a crowd of people, or to a class, that I didn't tell the Frontier Airlines story to. And I got some funny responses over the years before Frontier went broke, finally. Now, I'm not taking the credit for bankrupting Frontier. Frontier bankrupted themselves. That policy, along with, I'm sure, other policies, ensured the demise of their business because their business model was flawed. And the airline industry in America today has a flawed business model. And it says, to hell with customers, we're here for the bureaucracy. And I'm here to tell you, boys and girls, that that's the wrong motivation for a business model. That isn't going to fly. That isn't going to work. Now, of course, in a monopoly like Aeroflot, where they have the national airline and it's the only airline, and we don't have to give service, well, okay, you can probably get away with it. But if there's competition, you know, if there's any other answer, if there's any other way to do business, somebody's going to try to beat City Hall, and that's my business in life, is beating City Hall. I told you a couple of times, you know, I used to travel quite a bit, and I've got the money, and if I wanted to, I could afford to go to Hawaii. Now, I haven't been to Hawaii for 10 or 15 years, and I'm not going. So you people out in Hawaii are the net losers. And why can't I, or why won't I go to Hawaii? I'm not going to bend over and let some guy at the airport look up the crack of my butt. I'm not taking my shoes off. Now, if you ever get your head screwed on straight and start acting like intelligent people, you know, I might fly again. I got a letter here one day from Carnival Cruises, and they said, you know, for $199 or $99, you can go on this Carnival cruise. I told the wife, I said, boy, you're never going to see a Carnival cruise that cheap. It was right after that Hurricane Ivan, and nobody was going to Florida, and they were crying the blues and trying to get people to travel. I said, you know, we ought to do it. So I wrote them a letter back. I said, hey, can you get me down there to the Carnival cruise? I'd be happy to go with you, but you see, I don't have any identification. And they didn't write me back either. See, if you don't have identification, you can't take your Carnival cruise, can't get on an airliner. I'm not changing. I take the money that I would be spending on Carnival cruises and trips to Hawaii. You know what I do? I buy land, houses. I buy other things. I'm happy spending my money. and I spend it on other things other than frivolity. It hurts you hotel workers. It hurts all you hotel and innkeepers. It hurts you auto rental business people. Yeah, when a guy like George Gordon, and just multiply me by thousands that are like me, and say, hey, listen, you know, we're from the old school, and we want the kind of service that we got back in the 50s and 60s, and if we don't get it, we ain't spending it with you. Well, Frontier Airlines ultimately went upside down, and one guy came to me one time, told me a funny story. He says, I walked up to the Frontier counter, and I said, I'd fly on your airline, but I don't have any identification. And he looked at me, and he said, you know, you're the third person today that said that to me. You see, I not only told the people that I talked to, I said, I want you to tell everybody that you know. Now, boys and girls, everybody knows 10 people. And if one person tells 10 people, and those 10 people tell 10 people, and those 100 people tell 10 people, and those 1,000 people tell 10 people, you know, pretty soon the word spreads far and wide. Stay off of Frontier Airlines. And as I said, I wouldn't take credit for bankrupting Frontier Airlines. But let me tell you, boys and girls, Frontier Airlines already had a fire going, and George Gordon was busy throwing gasoline on their fire every time I got a chance. Now, don't tell me you can't beat City Hall. Now, I don't care whether it's the airline industry or whether you're talking about government or insurance companies or whatever it happens to be. You know, if you put your mind to it, you know, you can make a big difference. Just one person makes a big difference. You make a big difference for yourself. That's the place it starts. I made a big difference for George Gordon and his relationship with Frontier Airlines. When I instructed my what do you call this company that does your flights for you? You know, your travel agent. So we had a travel agent there in Boise. And I instructed the travel agent. I said, when you put our itinerary together, don't ever put me on a Frontier Airlines flight. And I told that guy the Frontier Airlines story. And it's a pain because, you know, sometimes the lowest fare and the connecting flight when you get off of United in Chicago might be a Frontier flight to Kansas City or Detroit or someplace else. And I remember my travel agent, he was really uptight. He said, surely you got to be kidding. I said, you'll see how much I'm kidding. The first time you book me on a Frontier flight will be the last sale you ever make to barristers in. My travel agent never put me on Frontier. And they never put anybody else at Barristers Inn on Frontier. And I told everybody to stay off of Frontier. And finally, they went upside down. So tell me you can't beat City Hall. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States. We're heard worldwide 7 days a week over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Okay, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.